From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today, we remember Wes Craven, the director best known for his horror films Scream and A Nightmare on Elm Street and their sequels. He died Sunday. We'll listen back to several interviews Terry recorded with him. Craven was influenced early in his career by the graphic media coverage of the Vietnam War and wanted his films to show violence for what it was.
The audiences went into a movie expecting to be entertained in the pure action or horror sense, where the blood is ketchup and the violence is simple and cartoonish. And instead, we said, now that we've got you here, by the way, this is what violence is really like.
Also, critic Milo Miles reviews a new collection of songs by Argentina's most famous pop star, and commentator Jessica Gross considers the challenges of parenting when preschools are making it harder for working parents. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by Travelzoo. Travelzoo, recommending the best travel, entertainment, restaurant, and spa deals to more than 27 million people worldwide. Whether you're at home or on the road, use the promo code FRESH at checkout on the Travelzoo app to get $5 towards any restaurant, spa, or activity voucher deal in September. Download the Travelzoo app to redeem.
Wes Craven, the filmmaker who revitalized and redefined the horror genre with his Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream movie franchises, died this week at age 76. Today on Fresh Air, we remember Wes Craven, who not only broke the rules of the horror genre, he helped codify the rules, and even listed and made fun of them through the mouths of the characters in his hit movie Scream. Kevin Williamson wrote the script, and Wes Craven directed.
Don't you know the rules?
What rules?
You don't... Jesus Christ, you don't know the rules?
Have an aneurysm, why don't you?
There are certain rules that one must abide by in order to successfully survive a horror movie. For instance, number one, you can never have sex. Big no-no!
Dead man.
Sex equals yes. Death, okay? Number two, you can never drink or do drugs. No, the sin factor. It's a sin. It's an extension of number one. And number three, never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
I'm getting another beer. You want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back.
Wes Craven was born in Cleveland, earned a master's degree in philosophy and writing, and briefly taught English as a professor before pursuing his dream of working in the movie industry. The first place he found work was behind the scenes in X-rated movies. But in the 1970s, he went mainstream, sort of, with such explicit and controversial drive-in cult classics as The Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes. He struck gold and box office success by writing and directing 1984's Nightmare on Elm Street, co-starring a young Johnny Depp. Then he helped launch another self-aware horror franchise in 1996 with Scream, currently spun off as a TV series for MTV. Today, we'll listen back to three of Wes Craven's Fresh Air interviews with Terry Gross. The first goes all the way back to 1980, when Fresh Air was still a local show. And Terry is here to tell us how that particular interview came about.
Well, David, the story of this interview begins on my vacation in Montreal with my now husband, Francis, in 1980. We wanted to go to the movies, and the Repertory House there was showing The Last House on the Left. Now, it so happens, Francis had read an essay about horror films that mentioned The Last House on the Left and talked about it as being an homage to the Ingmar Bergman film, The Virgin Spring. Pretty classy, right? So we go to the movie, and I was totally unprepared for what I was going to see. The movie is about two escaped convicts who are incredibly sadistic. They kidnap two teenage girls and proceed to rape, torture, disembowel, shoot, amputate, just like every horror imaginable. And it looks basically like a snuff film. It's so cheaply made that it looks like two sadists who have no idea how to make a movie are documenting their own sadistic acts. And at some point, I couldn't take it anymore. I thought, why am I watching this? So I left the theater. I came back in eventually because, well, in part because Francis was still there.
You had left something behind.
Yes. So I ended up watching eventually the rest of the film. But when I got back to Philly, I thought, I got to talk to the person who made this film and find out, like, why did you do this? What kind of person are you? And when I called him up, I wasn't sure what I'd find on the other end, like maybe a monster or a madman. And it turned out he was this, like, thoughtful, reflective, smart, articulate guy.
Okay, thanks for dropping in to explain that.
My pleasure, David.
So here we're going to go to all the way back to 1980 when Fresh Air was a local show, the first time that you interviewed Wes Craven.
You were commissioned to do the most violent movie possible. I wonder how you reacted to accepting an assignment like that.
Well, I didn't feel so hot about it, to be frank. In fact, I had a lot of qualms about doing such a thing. However, at the time, I was driving a cab in New York, out of work, and had a wife and two kids, and I was at the same time really excited about the idea of being offered a motion picture to write, direct, and edit. Especially since my last job had been, a very rudimentary job in a film. In other words, I was very new to the business, and this was an extraordinary stroke of luck to be offered a film to make from top to bottom. So I had very mixed feelings about it. I didn't want to do particularly a violent film. On the other hand, I did want to do a film very much.
Let me tell you about my reaction, and tell me what you think of this. I was sitting there saying, gosh, this is really awful. I don't want to see this. This is just going to give me images for nightmares. Who needs this? Why am I doing this to myself? And I figured my alternative reaction was to work really hard at detaching myself from what was going on the screen. And I figured, well, why should I use all that energy to undo an emotion that's probably really appropriate? I mean, I figured it was probably appropriate to really be horrified at what I was watching.
Well, it sounds like a healthy reaction to me. You know, I really think that it's not the sort of movie that I would go to, I don't believe. At the time that I made it, it was not the sort of movie I went to. My feeling when I was making it is, okay, if these people are going to be paying money to go in and see somebody killed, which in effect you're doing when anybody is doing if they go to a movie that they know is a murder thriller, then they're going to see what I feel this business is really like. As I mentioned to someone once before, it was during the height of the Vietnamese War, and I felt like America as a whole country, myself, was becoming immune to violence. We were watching it. I literally was watching people dying on my television screen while I was eating dinner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and several times caught myself, you know, with mouthfuls of food and nausea coming over me. What? You know, this is horrible. I mean, this is really horrible.
I really understand what you're saying, and I know that the movies I grew up on, even like the World War II and World War I movies, people were killed without any blood ever coming out.
That's right.
I think there's like.
And even when blood did come out, when it first came into the movies in a big way with Peckinpah, he used slow motion, and the squibs somehow weren't really.
It's very stylized.
Still, it was very stylized and ballet-like, and I still felt like you didn't really get down to the essence of the act, and that was depriving a living thing, a human being, of its life, of its very life force. And, it went beyond a simple matter of pulling a trigger. It went down into the, you had to look at that thing struggling to maintain that life, even though it had been shot or stabbed or whatever. It went back to something that happened to me when I was a kid. I don't know whether you'd be interested in hearing it, but at one point in my life, when I was living in kind of a poor neighborhood, we lived next to a railroad yard, and I don't think I probably, looking back on it, was very happy with my life. But anyway, one thing I found to sort of get rid of my craziness was I got a mail order bow and arrow set. I mean, a legitimate one. And I started hunting. And the only thing to hunt there were rats, because the railroad yard had this area where they kicked grain out of a cattle cart. And there were a lot of rats. And I started, almost by accident, started hunting rats. And it went a whole year before I got near to even hitting a rat. It turned out they were extremely canny, very, very alert. And I never got close to one for the first 6 months because it wasn't that good a shot. But I kept practicing and kept hunting these things. and kept wishing I would get one. Finally, one evening, almost dark, I took a shot at a rat after stalking it for half an hour, after sitting quietly and waiting for it to come out just right. I shot and I hit the thing. And instead of, and at that moment, this little tiny animal let out this enormous scream that echoed over all the boxcars in the stockyard and chilled me to the bone. I realized that what I had been thinking and fantasizing was totally different from what I had actually done. And not only that, but the thing was still alive. And I went down and I said, well, this is a rat. You know, nobody likes rats, but I had to kill it, and it took a lot of killing to kill that rat, and it continued screaming for a long time. And I tell you, when I was done, I was totally drained. I was totally shocked by what, not only what I had done for amusement, but how fiercely that thing struggled to stay alive. And that moment never left me. You know, I never again hunted, never killed. But I remembered how hard just a rat struggled to be alive. And somehow I was able to transfer that to, you know, the thought of any human being, anything. How fiercely we all hang on to life. You know,
I understand what you're saying about films being bloodless sometimes or being too stylized, and you don't really understand what murder is really like and how horrible it is and how difficult it actually is to kill someone. But I was looking around in the audience when I saw Last House on the Left, and somehow the range of reaction that the audience seemed to have was somewhere between immunity to the violence and actually digging what was happening. And I don't know what kinds of audiences you've seen your film with, but how do you feel about that type of reaction to it, immunity or enjoyment?
Well, I've never seen immunity, frankly. I've seen people, everything from shocked to disgusted to nauseated or angered, a lot of anger. And the other reaction I've seen sometimes is cheers when what some of those people would call the good guys, the parents and so forth, turn the tables and kill the bad guys. I find it scary. I've heard about audiences like that where they're all up in their feet and cheering and so forth. I've never seen an audience that was cheering when the bad guys, quote, quote, were killing the girls. But, you know, I would find that chilling. It certainly wasn't what I intended, but I've heard about that.
Filmmaker Wes Craven speaking to Terry Gross way, way back in 1980. The man who revitalized and redefined the horror genre with his Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream movie franchises died Sunday at age 76. Terry interviewed Wes Craven again in 1987 and asked again about his breakthrough horror film, Last House on the Left.
The violence in Last House on the Left and the scenes of rape and mutilation and torture are so intense. I mean, I ended up walking out of the theater for that scene because I just felt that I didn't want to have to remember it. if I saw it. And I wonder if that's the challenge that you took on for yourself, to make something more graphic and more realistic than it had ever been done before.
It was. It was very specifically the philosophy of it. You know, I had a certain ambivalence towards doing this sort of genre. As I said, it was not something that I loved. But I was intrigued by the idea of presenting anything that was exceptionally truthful, because I felt that most of the films that I'd seen that were made in America for popular audiences were distortions, and they quite often would present violence in a way that was either operatic or balladic or simply elliptic, so that you know, you would fade away before any true violence was done, or the act of violence would be very simple and antiseptic. Someone would be shot, clutch his chest, and fall down and die. A stab wound, you know, always killed with the first thrust. And parallel to the process of filmmaking in my own mind and in the minds of Sean, too, were the mass of media inputs from the Vietnam War, so that we were seeing reality of violence on our television sets, going into our theaters and seeing distorted, filtered reality. So that Sean and I set off to say simply, let's not cut away and let's not do violence that is entertaining. And I didn't. You know, I simply did not cut away. And one stab did not do it, and one shot did not do it. Once the violence began, the violence was treated absolutely really. And thus the outrage. The audiences were, in a sense, tricked. They went into a movie expecting to be entertained in the pure action or horror sense, where the blood is ketchup and the violence is simple and cartoonish. And instead, we said, now that we've got you here, by the way, this is what violence is really like.
What's the benefits of seeing that, though?
I think the benefits of seeing that is that it reaffirms reality rather than reaffirming a fantasy. Too much of American cinema dealt with reaffirming fantasies. It was a Disney-like approach to the entire spectrum of our reality. And at the same time, in the real world, quote, whatever the hell that is, we were seeing more and more of the veils stripped away, you know, the myth of American supremacy and infallibility, the myth of, you know, bombs dropped to win wars and you don't see the people that they hit. The reality that the American soldier was heroic and in all cases and never did anything that was terribly disturbing. All those were being stripped away in the public forum, but in cinema, we're still desperately trying to reaffirm the myths. And my feeling was it's time to stop dreaming. And I guess that's become the theme of my entire work. It's time to wake up.
I think in some ways that Last House on the Left became a forerunner of slasher films. And I wonder if you think that other film directors have taken the kind of graphic violence that you started to extremes that you find disturbing.
Well, I don't think it really was a forerunner to slasher films. I mean, there were the films of Stuart Gordon a long time before I made Last House. I think it more or less stands on its own. I mean, the genre in the sense of, you know, a man with a knife has been around. Hitchcock did it. And, you know, Hitchcock always boasted that you never saw the knife touch the flesh. Well, in my mind, as good as Hitchcock was, and I would never deny his genius, he denied the essence of the moment. And I always go on, there was a French philosopher that once said, it's all right to lie, that's what art is all about, but it's not all right to lie about the essence of the matter. And I've used that as my credo making films.
So you don't think that other people have taken what you've done to extremes that disturb you?
No, I don't. I don't think other people are that weak, or you know, are artistic Xeroxes. I think everybody goes off and does their own vision, and I don't take responsibility for other people's work. Frankly, it's bad enough taking responsibility for my own.
Well, has that been hard? I mean, really, have people made false assumptions about you based on your movies?
I don't know whether they're false or true. I mean, you know, sometimes the truth hurts too. But I certainly have had my experiences of people getting up and walking away, not only from my movies, but from me. You know, I was anathema in polite society after I made Last House. People literally would grab their children and run from the room. And I always found it an irony that, you know, the same people that would support a war or, you know, live a lifestyle that would require entire third world countries to be put in near slavery would at the same time be appalled by somebody that did something that was only effective within a certain closed dark room called a movie house. It was very interesting. I've experienced a great deal of, you know, ostracism from making of films. It's only been in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years that I've received real nice things from it.
You know, well, Wes Craven, you are from, I understand, from a fundamentalist Baptist background, and you had a pretty strict upbringing. And the way
Well, that explains it all.
No. I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you. No.
I'm smiling.
No, okay. No, but I wonder, you know, if it does seem to me, however, that you did kind of get a chance to unleash some pent-up feelings when you got into the horror film genre. I mean, for a man who didn't even get to see any movies till he was in college, you really went at it once you got into them yourself.
That's true. And I'm sure that did have a very profound influence on my energies and mind. You know, it's a lifestyle. I mean, I don't want to defame any religion or religious posture, but it is one based on you know, a view of the world that is very dark, very prescriptive, proscriptive, and, you know, can leave you with a tremendous sense of rage once you're out of it because you feel like you've been denied your youth, your joy.
What made you fall in love with movies when you started to see them?
They're so beautiful. I don't know. I always had an active dream life, and there's something so profound and wonderful about a movie. It's so alive. It's so shared. The thing of sitting in an audience and going into a dreamlike state with several hundred other people that are sharing exactly what you're feeling is a profound event. I think it's really, to me, it simply was something that nothing else quite did for me. And it also was something that I proved after many years of sort of searching for a voice. I mean, I did many things in my life. I painted and I played guitar and wrote and did many, many things. But it all seemed to come together in making movies, and almost accidentally. I mean, I was pursuing a career in writing and went to New York to make movies almost out of desperation of finding something that I really felt happy at. And all of a sudden, I just was good at it really fast. I made my first feature, you know, a year and a half after not knowing anything about making a movie whatsoever. So it simply was there, and I was there, and we crossed, and it was love at first sight between me and movies.
Wes Craven, he was responsible for two very popular and influential horror franchises, Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream.
Tatum, just get in the car.
Hello, Sydney.
Hi, who is this?
You tell me.
Well, I have no idea.
Scary night, isn't it? With the murders and all, it's like right out of a horror movie or something.
Randy, you gave yourself away. Are you calling from work? Because Tatum's on her way over.
Do you like scary movies, Sydney?
I like that thing you're doing with your voice, Randy. It's sexy.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Oh, come on. You know I don't watch that.
Why not? Too scared?
No. No, it's just, what's the point? They're all the same. Some stupid killer stalking some big-breasted girl who can't act, who's always running up the stairs when she should be going out the front door. It's insulting.
Are you alone in the house?
Randy, that's so unoriginal. I'm disappointed in you.
Maybe that's because I'm not Randy.
Terry Gross spoke to Wes Craven several times. Most recently in 1998, after Scream and Scream 2 had established the Wes Craven brand all over again. At that time, she asked him why he thought his hybrid of horror and satire worked so well.
I think the fact was that horror had reached one of its sort of classical, cyclical stages of ennui on the part of the audience. You know, it just had gone so far along the same lines that people were bored with it and kind of knew what to expect, and it kind of was in that place where it needed to be satirized, at least before you went on and did something new. You had to sort of acknowledge, this is where we've been, I know you're all bored, and I know you're thinking you know what's going to happen. So that became kind of the charm of it. In that sense, it's kind of a release, you know. It's like a joke about anything, and there's kind of a rush of relief that it's being talked about, very frankly, you know. So in the sense that you say, we know horror films have been either boring or stupid or predictable, there's kind of a rush of relief because they know, well, at least they're in the presence of somebody who is smart enough to figure that much out. Now let's see if they can do something new.
Now tell me what you found most predictable. Your characters have some opinions on that. what's your opinions?
Well, you know, you could quote some of the characters, you know, the big-breasted girl who runs upstairs instead of out the front door when there's a threat, and you know, who always goes to investigate and you know, sort of does the stupid thing rather than the smart thing. The classic situation of the girl running away from the monster and always falling down. You know, there's all those cliches in horror films that you know, we wanted to avoid and also acknowledge or stand on their head. So I think it was a large part of that, just the sort of stupidity. A sort of a built-in sexism quite often, a sense of gore for gore's sake, and also a very heavy emphasis on this sort of killer at the expense of any characterization of, you know, of the more normal people, if you will. And also a complete lack of recognition of the fact that these were events that were happening within the context of a society that had movies about these subjects. You know, people in the movies of this sort had never commented on the fact that they were in a situation very similar to movies that we all know and could easily talk about.
Right, and that they could use that knowledge to help them.
Exactly.
Now, I know you didn't see many movies as a kid. I think your parents were very religious.
Right.
And what were their fears about movies?
Well, I think that as much as I can put it together, because it was never expressed so much as it just was a fait accompli, when, you know, we just didn't go to movies, was that they were just too worldly, using that term that is used in that fundamentalist world, and that basically, I think, meant they were too sexual and too... I think probably the sexuality of it more than anything else was what disturbed them. But, you know, the fact of the themes and the subjects were too risque, too sexual, too whatever for to be of any good to the mind and body, which was considered the tabernacle of the Holy Spirit. So, you know, there was kind of a panoply of things that were not done or allowed. You know, smoking, drinking, playing cards, dancing, all of those things were forbidden. So it simply were not part of my life, and it wasn't a huge problem for me. I mean, if you're not aware of something, it's simply not there in a way. And
Where did you grow up? I mean, and how?
Cleveland, Ohio. It wasn't like I was living out in the middle of Holy Roller territory. It was just a fundamentalist Baptist church, and there were a lot of other churches that also believed the same thing. So it was, you know, at that time. And I wouldn't be surprised if there are still churches that have those general guidelines. It just was not, something that was done. My mother was very, very involved in the church, and the church was virtually the core of our social life. You know, we went all day Sundays and Wednesdays for prayer meetings and church camps and church daily vacation Bible schools and everything else. It was my world until I broke out of it. So. You know, it was just I was guided towards books and became a bookworm, and got my joy of storytelling out of reading novels, basically.
Do you feel that any of your horror films have addressed your innermost fears?
Oh, I think they all have. You know, I think there's a great deal in there that has to do with that, and I know that Freddy Krueger, and this is not to be. You know, this is the sort of thing that one's mother in Cleveland can hear by third hand and be horrified by. But I think there's a certain fear that I had for my father, for instance, that comes out in a grotesque form in like a Freddy Krueger, who is like the ultimate patriarchal, nefarious character, you know, who is dangerous and takes delight in sort of scaring the younger. That not that my father chased me around with a glove full of knives, but it was just like, to me, he was a scary person. He was not around a great deal, and he had a sharp anger, a bad temper, and I remember being quite afraid of him. I'm sure I translated some of those feelings as a small child into those kinds of characters, and a lot of my films have to do with sons facing, for instance, in Shocker, you know, facing a father who was a killer and who says basically it could be the same thing. So. You know, I don't think they would be anywhere nearly as strong as they have been if they were not in some way reflecting issues that were, you know, from deep inside myself.
I know when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, horror film meant usually a supernatural film, you know, Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman. You're one of the people who made the horror film more about teen anxieties and, slashers who prey on teenagers. Sometimes those slashers are fellow teenagers. Sometimes they're more supernatural kind of figures, you know, like Freddy Krueger. Tell me a little bit about how you think the meaning of horror films became transformed.
Well, it's. I think they're quite profound films. They are dealing with fear, which is certainly one of the primal emotions, and one of the most immediate signals of danger and the necessity for taking action or else not surviving, you know, so you can't get much more basic than that. And they always sort of perceive, what is sort of that subcutaneous, subconscious fear that's in the culture at the time. you know, there were lots of films in the 50s about, you know, the effects of atomic energy.
Mm-hmm.
There were early on films, I think, even at the dawning of science, about, you know, the effects of science on human conduct, for instance, like Frankenstein, you know, where you have, it's all based on what can be done medically, you know, to this person, and how that is either in control or not in control. And there was a long period of sort of psychosis as, you know, sort of the key element of fear, because it seemed like there were so many things that had happened in society. I think even post-World War II, where you had culture coming out of the sort of, you know, coming out of shock of what they had just seen of an entire world at war and these sort of horrendous events being perpetrated by, you know, by the Nazis and in a sense by everybody that, you know, went to war against each other.
Psycho would be a good example of that.
Psycho was a great example of that, and I wanted to mention that, you know, because that is a pure case of not a monster in the sense of a, you know, Godzilla mm-hmm. or something, but it's a human monster. I think, you know, horror films like Godzilla and King Kong are kind of a relief in a way, because they are so removed from our reality. They're a little bit more of a popular entertainment, although I think in some ways that they speak also to a sort of a subconscious dread that we have botched nature so much or offended it so much that it's going to come back and get us and destroy our cities, you know, because we are, you know, such sort of a carbuncle on the skin of nature, you know. But certainly with Psycho, you had that idea of the crazy person being the wild card that we would have to deal with even though we didn't want to, that it didn't fit into civilization at all, but simply it was there in a significant way. And that continued on through, I think, the 70s, you know, where it was psychotic people like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, the rural family that had sort of gone back to some primeval state. The Hills of Eyes was something like that, too. And there was a shift towards almost a mythological-type father figures with the Michael Myers, the people behind the mask, and Freddy Krueger, and in a sense Jason, too, where they were not really human, but some sort of almost quasi-human killing force, you know, that was completely outside morality. It's also it's kind of a spin-off, I think, of the psychotic figure. I think part of the innovation of the Scream series, and it's, you know, it's a sort of a triptych conceived by Kevin Williamson, the writer, is that when the mask was off, it was not, you know, sort of a mythological creature like a Freddy Krueger, who was almost was not really truly human, but it was the kid next door, your boyfriend.
Filmmaker Wes Craven speaking to Terry Gross in 1998. He died Sunday at age 76. In Argentina, tango singer Carlos Gardel remains the country's most famous pop star, even though he died young in a plane crash 80 years ago. Music critic Milo Miles reviews a new collection of Gardel's recordings, which Milo says will introduce the singer to a new worldwide audience.
Chiflao en mi tristeza, te evoco y veo que has sido en mi pobre vida paria solo una buena mujer. Tu presencia de bacana puso calor en mi nido, fuiste buena, consecuente, y yo sé que me has querido como no quisiste a nadie, como no podrás querer.
Many music fans could name at least one famous tango instrumentalist, Astor Piazzolla. Far fewer, I suspect, would be able to name even one tango singer. But if you are a tango enthusiast, there is far and away one vocalist, the timeless Carlos Gardel. Tango is arguably the first international music craze with its potent combination of dance and dramatic tunes. And Gardel became its voice, celebrated in New York and Paris. After all, he was born in France in 1890 before emigrating with his single mother to Buenos Aires when he was 3. But the tragic end of his life eclipses all other events. In 1935, at the peak of his fame, the 44-year-old Gardel perished in a plane crash in Colombia, along with his most renowned lyric writer, Alfredo Lepera. Gardel does have a large recorded legacy, some 750 titles, including a definitive vocal rendition of the most famous tango.
Conservo aquel cariño que tuve para ti. Quién sabe si supiera que nunca te he olvidado. Volviendo a tu pasado, te acordarás de mí. Los amigos.
But there are technical problems with Gardel's original recordings. The importance of his new anthology on Rough Guide is revealed through the title, Carlos Gardel, Reborn and Remastered. A little history of sound fidelity on records is needed here. Back in the 1970s, I returned the first blues recordings from the 1920s I bought because they were so scratchy and muffled, I thought they must be defective. I was informed that one mark of a true aficionado was being able to pick out the music from the noise on LPs. Remastering has advanced mightily from that era. Listeners aren't going to pick through noise anymore, and as the liner notes to Reborn and Remastered correctly put it, some of the original songs sound small, tinny, and fragile, as if played by miniature musicians at the bottom of a gramophone funnel. Gardel debuted with a hit in 1917, the year the initial jazz records were made. This reissue finally fixes that crude sound. By the 1930s, recordings were better, and full orchestras were considered properly modern and big-time for a star like Gardel. Before now, though, reissues reduced these performances to Gardel's voice smothering clusters of strings behind him. The Rough Guide's much more nuanced remastering is evident on the presentation of the beloved ballad, The Day That You Love Me.
El día que me quiera, la rosa que engalana. Se vestirá de fiesta con su mejor color y al viento la carpara dirá que ella es mía y loca la portara se cortará de su amor. La noche.
Popular singers from Gardel's time tend to sound like a heap of mannerisms slathered in sentimentality. Gardel conquers this in true tango cowboy fashion by being a bit of a rogue. Yes, he specializes in heartbreak, but he always throws in a smile and a wink to let you know that although he's sad, he's not feeling sorry for himself. This magnetism is already in place in his earliest recording, the bold and hungry lament, My Sad Night, which has never sounded so vibrant.
Per corto caes mi abrace en lo mejor de mi vida dejando penar en mi herida y afín en el corazón sabiendo que te quería que vos eras mi alegría y mi sueño abrazador. Para mí ya no hay consuelo y por eso me impulse a olvidarme de tu amor. Cuando voy a mi cotorro.
The final curious quality of Gardel's recordings is that he seems to have several voices, some lighter, some louder, some hearty, some almost airy. Is this the result of the studio setup or Gardel's skill at varying his persona? I would say projecting his persona, which he did in his 11 films as well. I would recommend the lighthearted movies like Tango Bar or Tango in Broadway. The camera confirms Gardel was a superstar with a radiant, one-of-a-kind smile and as sexy as a guy with a quart of grease in his hair could be.
Milo Miles reviewed Carlos Gardel, Reborn and Remastered on the World Music Network label. Like many parents this time of year, journalist Jessica Gross is sending her daughter off to school for the first time. As a working parent, she wonders a lot, not only about what her child will face, but what she will. Gross is the editor of Lenny, Lena Dunham's email newsletter. And you might remember her from the panel discussion we had on Fresh Air in July about women's voices.
My daughter starts preschool full-time next week, and we are all prepared. Her California grandma sent her a new backpack festooned with flowers and embroidered with her name. We bought sunflower seed butter for her school lunches because peanut butter is now banned, so that no allergic child has to break out his EpiPen. And we also scrambled to find a week of afternoon childcare, because even though this is a program with an extended day that lasts until 6, during the first week school ends at noon. The school's impulse isn't bad. Ostensibly, this is so the kids can have a gradual acclimation to their new surroundings. But for a family with two working parents like ours, this is a nightmare scenario. And what's especially frustrating is we sent our daughter here in the first place because it was the neighborhood school most friendly to working parents. The other nearby schools either had half-day schedules or just 2 hours a day, 3 days a week. I know about all the other schools and their schedules because just getting your kid into a preschool, there's no public options for three-year-olds, is a time-consuming undertaking. We had to fill out applications a year in advance when our girl was not yet two. One of the applications asked, "What are your child's educational goals?" I remember looking over at my pre-verbal toddler while she climbed in and out of an empty diaper box. I thought her educational goals are learning how to count, figuring out how a potty works, differential calculus. I was so annoyed by the absurdity of that question and how phony any of my answers would be, I didn't even finish the application. During this process, we learned that there was such a thing as preschool legacy. You see, my husband had gone to a popular preschool in the neighborhood, so we got a special tour and an interview there. I was prepared to hate the school. It was the most expensive of the bunch, and it had the most inconvenient hours. But as we toured, I realized it was a gorgeous, happy place with a lovely rooftop playground and devoted teachers. Liking the school made me feel guilty and irritated. I'm well aware that there are huge economic disparities in American children's access to education, but being confronted with my kids' privilege was bracing. I wasn't used to grappling so directly with the special access we get in so many parts of our lives. All kids should be able to go to places like this. After we decided on the right school for us, we were informed that we must provide snacks for the whole class on a rotating basis. They sent a list of acceptable snacks, which included fresh fruits and veggies, no-sugar cereal, and they name-checked Cheddar Bunnies, the upscale version of Goldfish crackers, specifically. When I got the list, I had a mental image of myself running to the supermarket at 9 on a work night because I had forgotten about snack week on top of all the other picayune details of my daughter's schedule of playdates and doctor's appointments and birthday parties. Certainly an extra supermarket trip for Cheddar Bunnies is not a big deal in the scheme of things. But I know that this is only the beginning of more than a decade of increasing obligation, of pressure to join the PTA and to become the class parent and to bake cookies and to raise money, even at public schools. Books like Bridget Schulte's Overwhelmed and Jennifer Senior's All Joy and No Fun have cataloged how much time the modern working parent now spends on parenting. Mothers in particular bear the brunt of this time suck. Schulte notes that working moms now spend as much time taking care of their kids as stay-at-home moms did in the 60s. 11 hours a week. That's compared with 7 hours a week with working dads. These hours ratcheted up over the past couple decades. My parents, who both worked full-time, can count on one hand the number of obligations they had at our public schools in the 80s and 90s, and nearly all those obligations were after business hours. Somehow, as the proportion of working mothers and single mothers has increased, the institutions their children attend behave more and more like there's a stay-at-home parent around to pick up the slack. Here, I should note that I couldn't be luckier or more privileged, to the point where it feels pretty churlish to complain. I have a husband who shares childcare equally. We're financially able to afford private preschool, and our daughter got into a wonderful one that we're mostly thrilled with. After some negotiations, my parents were able to pick up my daughter from preschool during that first week of half days. If for whatever reason my parents couldn't babysit, I would have found a way to work from home those afternoons without losing my job. The kid would have survived being parked in front of Peppa Pig for a few hours while I tried to work. If I were a single parent, or a parent with an inflexible or low-paying job, or a parent without her own parents nearby, I'd be in big trouble. According to Child Care Aware of America, almost 30% of parents polled in 2014 experienced some kind of child care breakdown in the past 3 months. Those breakdowns are especially difficult for families already paying dearly for care. Full-time care for very young children can cost about half a year's salary for a family of three living at the poverty line. I do think that there's some cultural pushback against all this time and energy expended by working parents and the workplaces that leave no room for families. But it's going to take a while to dismantle the framework that's been a couple of decades in the making. I would love to just drop my kid off at preschool at 8:30 on day one and pick her up at 6, but they won't let me. For now, I guess the only option is to be grateful that I can make it work for my own small family in this moment, until we have another child and all hell breaks loose.
Jessica Gross is a journalist and novelist and editor of Lenny, Lena Dunham's email newsletter. On Monday's show, for the Labor Day holiday, one of our favorite recent interviews with Louis C.K. He'll tell us about his start in stand-up when he bombed.
I just choked through like 2 minutes of jokes, and I just walked off stage to kind of confused, like, little applause.
Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Adam Stanishevsky, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Well, school days, dear old golden rule days, reading and writing and arithmetic, taught to the tune of a hickory stick. I was your bashful favorite beau, and you was my girl in Calico. Humpty, Humpty Dumpty, he sat upon the wall. Yeah, Humpty Dumpty on the wall. Humpty Dumpty had a fall, and all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty back again. Jackie Horner was sitting in the corner. Well, Jackie Horner.